down the drum.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 762.2K0930, certificate number 29266. Mary Kay Pink Cadillacs.
We were in Glacier National Park last week.
With
the kids. Yeah, you and I.
I barely remember.
Got a little getaway. Well, it was a pretty wild week.
Woo.
We melted all the glaciers.
Yeah, I must have been eating applets and cotlets, and
they don't have applets and cotlets there. Do you know what they have there?
In Glacier?
Yeah.
Glacelets and ringlets? What?
They have hucks.
What are hucks?
That's Huckleberry Country.
Huckleberry.
It's a huckleberry-based economy, lifestyle, aesthetic. It's hard to overstate the importance of huckleberry to Western Montana.
Is there a jamboree by any chance?
There's got to be. I mean, not in COVID year.
Right.
But there's got to be a huckleberry parade, Miss Huckleberry, Huckleberry Hound.
Sure.
The huckleberry cannot be domesticated. Domesticated? Is that what the word?
Sure, I think so.
I don't know if that's true.
No.
Are there wild huckleberries that used to surround our tents until we got them to watch our flocks?
Did we talk about huckleberries in the Boysenberry episode?
I don't think we did. What a lacuna. What a gaping hole in our berry knowledge.
I do feel like domesticated is the word. You cannot domesticate a huckleberry.
Do you feel like you can domesticate corn?
I'm looking for wild corn is what I'm looking for.
I guess what I mean is commercially cultivated.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe that's not the same as domesticated.
I think we're on the same page.
You can't plant a field of huckleberries. That's what
I'm
saying.
And why not?
I have no idea. I think they need
bees.
they need some kind of natural forested environment, and maybe it's just inefficient.
I see.
To try to produce it. So they have to be foraged, basically. So every late
so
July,
an army of bears has been domesticated.
You're fighting the bears. Like the bear we saw, we drove in the gates of Glacier on our first day there, and the kids are all excited to see wildlife. And I'm like, sometimes you don't see the wildlife. And there's a black bear like right by the big photo sign, just like looking for delicious huckleberries.
Sometimes you see the bar, and sometimes the bar sees you.
Yeah, I killed me a bar when I was only three.
Hmm.
That's a crime now in the state of Montana. So
to kill a bar?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're protected. We actually did see a grizzly with a bunch of cubs walking around too. Yeah.
Really?
And people are just crowding around taking flash photos. I was like, this is going to go badly.
Wait, there are still flash photos? Did they have a Kodachrome?
They had a giant camera with they're holding a flash thing in their right hand. And the bear's like, covering its eyes.
So were people getting out of their cars and trying to get closer to the bear?
Traffic stopped both ways on the road. Here's what happened. The park, there was a piece in the Washington Post last weekend about the travails of Glacier National Park. The Blackfoot Reservation decided to close their borders during COVID, basically.
Yeah.
Which is not crazy. The reses are just getting devastated
makes,
by the virus.
Makes good sense to me.
And the, you know, their culture is to protect the elders. You know, that's who would, you know, if the tourists continue to sweep across the Blackfoot Reservation, that's who gets sick. So unfortunately, that means you cannot get into the eastern side of Glacier National Park. Glacier National Park is now essentially a shoebox diorama.
I see.
With one end open to Idaho and then a closed back.
And so you have to do the loop and go back out through Idaho.
There's not even a loop. There's one road. Like in the 20s and 30s, they just blew. Have you ever been to Glacier?
Never been.
It's just this. It's gorgeous, by the way. Like yeah. Dylan got out of the car at one point, and you know, this jaded 17-year-old. He's like, "Are you seeing this?" And I was like, "What?" And he's like, The mountains, and like he just couldn't believe what he was seeing. It got him to look up from Skyrim. He's like, "This is like real Skyrim."
Yeah.
Then he went back and played more Skyrim.
So you get to the end. There's a cul-de-sac.
And yeah. So there's this one road that goes across the park, which normally would connect West Glacier and East Glacier. East Glacier is the reservation, and is the borders are closed, and the park's announced it's just not going to open. So while we were there, they finally got this road plowed and open, because it's this insane V-shaped glacial valley where in the 20s and 30s. With 20s and 30s technology, they just had to go through and just try to dynamite a ledge into these sheer cliffs.
Right.
And I think it was mostly for the railway. The Great Northern Railway needed to go through there. But they also built all these beautiful kind of ski chalet style grand old hotels on the lakes.
So does it come out? Where does it come out? Does it come out around? Where is the Blackfoot Reservation?
This is all north of Yellowstone. You know, the Yellowstone Tetons are kind of
south,
right? Like, you know, the top of Yellowstone is in Montana, but just barely.
Right.
Most of it's in Wyoming. So this is north all the way to the Canadian border. Glacier National Park is actually the world's first international peace park because it's got this little Canadian adjunct.
I see.
Waterton Glacier Park or something that sticks up across the border.
And can you get to it? Can you get to the Canadian part from inside the park?
Generally, yes. Now, currently with the border closed,
right.
No. So it's a perfect representation of one of those population maps of North America where suddenly Canada's this little tiny hat sitting on big America. That's what Glacier National Park looks like. It's whatever those sub-ranges of the Rocky Mountains are called.
The Sawtooths or something.
It is the Lewis Range.
Oh, the Lewis Range.
And some other range. But it's all the way north. So it's by Kalispell.
Yeah.
I mean, it's nice. There's enough, you know, kind of fly fishing and other tourism there that there's like, you know, 45 minutes away. Lewis and Livingston ranges. So there's a big city with a Costco and a Target 45 minutes away. But
That's nice.
We just stayed in a little cabin right by the park. We decided not to. We had this trip planned all year and we decided, look, if we just do it as a road trip, stay in this cabin, you know, we're not any bigger of a COVID footprint than anybody else.
I used to go skiing at Schweitzer, which is up there sort of north of Sandpoint. But I guess you're even...
In Idaho?
In Idaho, yeah.
It's a couple hours across the border, but it's surprisingly close to Seattle. Like, I was amazed at what a doable day trip it is. Even with stopping for lunch and gas, you can do the drive in 9 hours.
Oh, wow, great.
So we got back last night at 6. So the Blackfoot have closed this. So this road, where these beautiful vistas and overlooks are, just kind of ends at the little kind of mini mall convenience store town on the east end of the park, and then you have to.
You know, there's a town up there called Jennings.
Is that right? In Idaho or Montana?
Jennings, Montana.
Why didn't I go see my birthright?
Right there, next to Libby on Highway 37. I'm looking at the map now in the Kootenai National Forest.
That's where we were. I think I thought Jennings, Montana, was like Joe Montana's Butler brother. Mm. You're displeased with that. So this road had been closed to snowplow. So the bears were just used to walking up and down it, I think.
Yeah.
So we just drive up and everyone's freaking out. Traffic stopped both ways because this mama grizzly bear and two cubs are just kind of stomping right next to the road. And of course the ranger comes up like, "What are you idiots doing? Everybody get 100 yards away from the bear." And she moves people and they just kind of, it's like water, you know, they just kind of flow back to another place where they can dangerously see the bear. People who die by bear deserve it.
I saw that growing up in Alaska a lot. You know, a grizzly bear appears to be fairly lazy and slow moving, like approachable even.
But it turns out it's conserving energy to strike.
It can exhibit a burst of speed.
It's been all those huckleberries it's been eating. It can metabolize all that huckleberry sugar and then suddenly, like, faster than the eye can meet, it'll have a fly in its chopsticks.
Now, black bear you can mess with all day. I highly recommend just go up and poke it with a stick. Just try and antagonize it. It can't do anything. Its claws are plastic.
This is your advice to the children of America. Yeah, yeah. If you see a bear,
if you're listening to this program and you can tell that it's a small bear, go up and kick it.
Go have some fun.
Go kick it.
Go kick it.
It's full of laughs. Bears love it. They love it. They like to play.
It wants to be kicked.
But a grizzly bear.
Bears crave discipline.
Stay away. Danger.
Isn't it tricky in that some black bears are colored brown and maybe some brown bears are colored black?
You know, there was a black bear for a long time in the Anchorage Zoo that that they captured in Juneau because he kept coming down out of the mountains into the town.
To use the ATM.
And he was blue.
What?
He was a black bear who had a kind of, there was a sheen to his coat, and he really looked blue, like you know, kind of silver blue, but not silver, very blue. And he was so fascinating. I think they captured him in Juneau, and as they do all the time, and they would have just repatriated him to some forest 10 miles away, except he was blue. And so they couldn't, you know?
Well, they can't. He'll be bullied.
And that's right.
It's like the loon with the broken leg. You can't just release that.
So they did him a huge favor, which was put him in a 20 by 20 cage in the Anchorage Zoo.
And threw popcorn at him for 30 years?
And every resident of Anchorage went by and looked at him. He was a beautiful bear.
Was it a sad cement thing? Or did you feel like at least he has a nice little home?
You know, the Anchorage Zoo, at least when I was growing up, was really felt like one of those ad hoc zoos where there was a guy that had a that won a llama at the state fair and he built a fence around it. And then he bought like a merry-go-round off the back of a truck, and then but it honestly, we had an elephant there. And
one of Alaska's few elephants.
It was an elephant that did watercolors, like a full on elephant, one of the great elephants, you know.
And top 10 elephant.
But it was really easy to fill the zoo with bears, moose, wolverines, because you could just kind of walk across the street and shake a tree, and a wolverine would fall out of it. So it was an interesting zoo. That's the one with Binky the bear that some kid went over the fence and Binky grabbed him and shook him by the peanuts, and then
like his bag of peanuts, or is that a euphemism?
He shook him by his euphemism, and then the kid lost a shoe or something, and Binky walked around in his enclosure with this high top tennis shoe in his mouth for a couple of weeks, and they couldn't get it away from him.
That's a power move.
It was a super bad look for the zoo because everybody knew that this kid got kind of mauled.
And the kid's still there. The bear's just slowly eating him over a course of weeks.
The kid's skeleton is there.
The kid's still there. Everyone loves to see Binky and Steve's skeleton.
Oh, no, Binky kept feeding the kid for a while. Broke both his legs.
While we were in Glacier, there was, you know, it felt a little bit crowded because everyone's kind of crammed into one corner of the park, and you had to make some effort to stay away from crowds,
That seems like a good place to go in quarantine.
It wasn't never crowded. It was just more than a usual summer, even though there were like fewer people than summer.
Because you couldn't turn around.
Yeah. So we kept seeing the same cars in the parking lot, you know, just some car that said RV for sale, and here's a phone number, even though there's no RV. So, you know, you get to know these people.
Did you call the number?
I didn't. Should I announce it on the show?
You get to know these people. I mean, really, you know, we all just got to know each other. And
haven't you ever been on the tourist trail somewhere and like seen the same people at, you know, the people you see at the Louvre, you also see at lunch or, no, that's never happened to you?
It
happens at Disneyland. You're always in the same line with the same annoying kids.
For whatever reason, like early on in my life, I resolved never to be a tourist. And it's a kind of a problem, like a mentality problem of a certain kind of person. Like, I'm not going to be a tourist. And so in order to not be a tourist, you routinely have to make a choice between, do I see the cool thing and risk being a tourist? Or instead, do I go like stand behind a dumpster and have lunch covered in rats and pigeons in order to continue to enforce this kind of anti-tourism, like sort of hair shirt.
My brother has that.
Yeah.
The self conception of himself as a tourist is too much to bear, even if it means not seeing the Eiffel Tower.
And so I over the last 30 years, I've made so many decisions to where in order to avoid being a tourist, I did not. I've never been to Glacier. I've never been to Yellowstone, because I was just
that's wilderness, John. Those are mountains.
I don't want to go to Yellowstone with a bunch of, what is it, Yogi Bear in there with his you know, like rub-a-dub-a-dub. Like I don't want to sleep next to a trash can. And so I've never been, and it's dumb, right? It's
pretty good. Those places are popular for a reason. It's not just like wall drug or something.
The only time I've ever been to the Louvre, I actually was, I was dressed all in black and I roped in after hours.
You come in upside down. You've only seen the Mona Lisa upside down.
That's right.
I thought she was frowning.
I was there. I was just there to steal diamonds, but I did take a look at some of the other paintings.
That was good to make the time. Among the cars we kept seeing over, you know, you only see the memorable ones. You only remember the guy with the dented bumper or whatever. Sure. We kept seeing this kind of pearly, whitish Cadillac crossover. And
cross, you mean like SUV?
Yeah, like a you know what a crossover is, like some weird hybrid between the Boysenberry of station wagons and SUVs. Some of
the Escalade, but it's got a pickup truck in the rear.
It does not.
It's like party in the front, business in the back.
It looks like a station wagon with a pituitary problem or a SUV owned by somebody with a small garage.
I see. Okay.
It's like this middle, it's like the most popular car segment in America right now.
Sure, I think, a SUV.
Right, yeah, we call them SUVs. You haven't been to the Louvre and you never bought a SUV. SUVRE.
I've been thinking about buying a SUVRE lately, but don't let me interrupt your story.
I think we are also switching to crossover because we're aging out of minivans. And so this car is this weird kind of whitish color where it looks different in different light.
Maybe pearlescent.
Maybe like your bear. It's pearlescent. You've seen the cars that do the thing where it's like some Batmobile color where it looks purple from one side and then you walk by and it's slightly green, like it's
that's a super hot paint bubble. Job. That's a deluxe double-sided paint job.
They do it by putting some kind of metallic flakes in the paint, and it has more layers than any normal car paint job.
Yeah.
I think it's
50 layer candy flake.
I think it's ugly as but it's fun for a second, or it's fun to walk by. Sure. You know, for the owner, it must be annoying. They've taken one for the team. Like,
not sure what team. Asked them to take
walk it. Walk by my car once, and you'll be delighted. And the kids were like, "What is this color?" Because it kind of looks whitish, and then it looks kind of rosy from the other side. And we saw under the little Cadillac shield, silver Cadillac shield on the side at the base of the driver and passenger side door. It said Mary Kay.
Oh, and so Mary Kay.
I was able to explain.
Were you able to explain?
In general terms, I was able to say, if you sell a lot of makeup to your neighbors, or more accurately, make your neighbors sell a lot of makeup to their neighbors, and so on, exponential fashion, you get one of these. But I didn't actually know that much about it.
Now, growing up, and I'm never clear of the timeline, but you moved to Korea at what age?
Like seven.
At seven. Early and you 80s. Stayed there until high school.
Yeah.
And so did you have Mary Kay Cadillacs in Korea?
No.
No.
Mary Kay is an international company now, right, in areas where it's allowed. But no, this is something I would have kind of, like almost everything else about American culture, just kind of absorbed through sidelong sitcom references and Mystery Science Theater riffs.
But someone my age,
you like, actually would have seen these bubblegum pink.
The Mary Kay cars were, and this was even in the 70s when cars had unusual colors, avocado and whatever, mustard.
Those weren't even unusual at the time.
Those were,
at the time, blue was weird because you had to get avocado or mustard.
Right. Avocado and mustard is how they came off the assembly line, and then you could paint them blue with house paint.
One day, Henry Ford III was eating an avocado and mustard sandwich.
Although you could get a Ford Torino in sky blue for a period in the 70s, but it was sky blue. It wasn't any kind of blue you would want. Really, kind of blue.
A powder blue.
But these pink cars, I mean, the only people that had pink cars were Elvis and Liberace. And yet every town had, there was generally, depending on what part of town you lived in, there was a Mary Kay car that was like your Mary Kay car.
Because there'd only be one in town.
Right, you saw it all the time. But if you went over to the other side of town, you might see a different Mary Kay car that was like a shocking surprise.
And it's almost like the Wienermobile, you know, like as late as the 90s, they had only given out 7,000 of these
paint
jobs. Yeah.
Wow.
So it really was like seeing the Goodyear blimp, except on a more accessible local level.
But they weren't like like a subtle pearlescence.
No, at the time they were Pepto-Bismol pink.
Pink.
So pink. That was the brand.
Yeah,
you were supposed to notice.
They were killer.
I think they realized at some point that nobody wants that color, and new car technologies have allowed for a. And I didn't know until I saw this one in the Glacier parking lot, and then again in Whitefish, and then again, it's a much classier look.
Yeah, although my sense was, at least from the one woman that drove a Mary Kay car in my part of Anchorage, was that it was the kind of, if you were a Mary Kay salesperson, your aesthetic was...
You wanted that color?
Well, because she seemed like a lady that had like a lot of diamonds on her fingers and... Like, yes. Had her hair done all the time.
You mentioned Liberace. She was a friend of Liberace.
Yeah, she was a fancy lady, and the pink car was...
Not just a fancy lady, a fancy Texas lady.
A fancy Texas lady.
With all the aesthetic that implies.
That's exactly right. Exactly right.
Mary Kay Ash was a Houston native. She had three kids with her first husband, who then went away to World War II. And as soon as she raised three kids during the war, and as soon as he got home, he told her he was leaving her. He was a...
He'd fallen in love with a medic.
I assume there was another woman. He was, because he's a musician, and that's what they do.
Oh, dear.
I don't know. Where should I start, John?
Saxophonist, probably.
Even worse.
Huh?
Ukulele.
Come on.
He played with a band called the Hawaiian Strummers.
Oh, and sure. That was fashion at the time.
Yeah, think of a time when ukuleles are not being played by cute indie girls and their boyfriends.
Right.
But instead by...
By guys in Aloha shirts with their hair slicked back.
And, yeah, so he and his group, the Ukulele Strummers, were one of Texas's premier Hawaiian music.
Right.
Did I say the Ukulele Strummers? The Hawaiian Strummers, I think is what they were called. So he divorced her, leaving her with three kids and no good living in the post-war era.
My goodness, this story starts off with a tragedy.
It's really going to pull out into a different tragedy.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
as a single woman in the 1940s, she didn't have that many options for putting... food on the table, but there was direct sales. As early as the 1920s or so in America, companies had started this idea that, startup costs for a business are tough, but we send you the stuff, you sell it to your friends, you go door to door, and you keep half the proceeds. And this was the model that was very appealing to a 1940s housewife without a lot of capital to open up a dry cleaning store or whatever.
Appealing to me even now.
If you thought, what would you like to sell to your neighbors, John? You're wearing, by the way, a very bright pink shirt. Thank you for theming this.
Yeah, bubblegum pink. What I'm trying to sell to my neighbors is that, it's a line of BS is what I'm trying to sell.
That they should just bring over money? You basically have a neighborhood Patreon.
Well, no, I'm selling it to my neighbors on the internet every day. It's just a straight line of BS that I'm hoping they buy, and it seems like they do.
But you don't have any product for them.
Oh, product. This is something I'm always trying to figure out, a way to actually make a thing that people would want to buy. And I've never really come up with anything better than a t-shirt design or an album. And an album it's not primarily a thing I want people to buy.
What if you left Barsook and just wandered around your neighborhood selling copies of your records, like a mixtape guy in the U District?
You know, honestly, what it is I'm not a salesman. And to be a salesman is to be a type of person, right? Yes. It's to be to sell is a gift and also a pathology.
I was about to say it's a kind of person that nobody likes, but in fact, that's not true.
It's the opposite.
By definition, these must be
people that everybody likes.
Charming, likable guys on the train.
Yeah, that's right. Who have just taken their natural gift and perverted it into... a way of like earning money, not perverted, but I don't know. My relationship to sales is complicated. Like I think most Americans, because we've all been,
I don't like to be sold things.
Right. We've all been confronted with an aggressive salesperson.
And I don't like to sell things. As a kind of a plain, humble Protestant American type.
Yeah.
I dislike the idea. Even when we have to say, hey, we have a Patreon. If you like the show, I feel like it's immodest somehow.
I'm uncomfortable with it too. And yet there are people around the world who are selling things. And also there are a lot of, I think a lot of things in our lives that we have to be grateful that someone was selling it.
Sure.
Right. I mean, that's the mentality of a salesperson, is that they're here to do you a favor.
The problem is you don't know if you got good advice. because the salesman is not a disinterested party.
Right.
Like maybe in my house, I have the right dishwasher because some salesman actually did a sincere hard sell. And maybe I have the wrong car because some salesman just wanted a bigger commission.
When you're online and you're trying to decide which angle grinder to buy, for instance, how do you determine in trying to find reviews, in trying to find some way to filter, how do you determine which ones are unbiased and which ones are product placement or paid placements?
I feel like I have no idea.
Do you spend time doing it?
I do, and I'll look at reviews and I'll be like, well, because it's all going to be something from China, you know?
Yeah.
Like just imagine going on some e-tail site and being like, you know what? I need more face masks, or I need more whatever. Like, what's the thing here that doesn't suck? And sometimes it's suspicious. Brand new thing, five-star reviews that are all kind of minimal.
Right, and all written in the same syntax.
Seems astroturfy.
You know, I always trusted Consumer Reports.
Oh, bad boy. But this show's mostly about Consumer Reports. Yeah,
I know, because we are, that's who we are. But lately I've found that there's something suspect about the way Consumer Reports, at least on their app.
What?
I just don't kind of like the way their app is designed, but also, I don't know, man, they're talking about—
Do you think they sold out?
No, but I just feel like they're, like us, right? Everybody at Consumer Reports grew up within a Consumer Reports universe, and it's become, it feels like AAA almost, that it's become a cult in and of itself.
It's kind of a monopoly. They have a little too much power.
Yeah, and you just don't get the feeling that it's not that they've sold out, but it feels like it has internal biases. Right?
I remember when it was about the reports.
It was about, you know what it was about? It was about that back page called Selling It.
Yeah.
Where they exposed like weird ads, weird sales techniques.
There was some TV show like that where I was a kid, this consumer advocate figure you may remember from the early 80s named David Horowitz, who would show up on morning shows and be like, he'd be like the America's ombudsman, who'd be like,
right,
don't believe this scammy ad for whatever. You don't actually need to buy six cans of Progresso. You get the same price if you just buy one. I'm on your side.
Yeah, there are too many insect parts in these pastas.
He actually had a short-lived TV show where he would get the audience to yell, fight back, at his pro-consumer crusades.
Oh, fight back.
I really liked that. That's how you can tell I was a little Occupy Wall Street kid in training.
Oh, if we could only return to a time when the thing we were concerned most about was that Progresso was trying to convince us
to buy too many flats.
Yeah, that it was a good sale when it was really just standard price.
In this direct sales universe, Mary Kay kind of did what you would imagine that being in the 40s. She was selling a series of books door to door, you know, like child rearing books, like, you know, the first two volumes are free, you know, kind of this kind of thing.
And this smacks of kind of a tragic desperation move, right? Like a single mom ringing doorbells out.
There's just not a lot of, will keep coming up again in the story. Not a lot of opportunities for moms who have kids to raise, because you can't, even assuming a plethora of 9-to-5 jobs that would take women in 1948 or whatever, you've got kids at home, you know?
But imagine the kind of plucky optimism she would have to screw onto her face.
Man.
Ring the doorbell, the door opens, it's a fellow mom probably opening the door.
Imagine her checking her lipstick and her compact before each door. You can do this, Mary Kay. You can do this.
And that fellow mom is going to look at her and go, oh, look at you. It's so too bad that you have to work and you have to screw on enough confidence that you're not going to be like destroyed by that condescension.
Destroyed by the bless your heart.
Yeah.
How many bless your hearts can you take a day?
And you're trying to sell this book, but you don't, you know, and you don't want to have a pity sale, but you're not going to turn down a pity sale.
There would have been more of a culture of women at home delighted to see another woman at home. Right. So, you know, a charming person could get by on that.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have that today. Like, ooh, the doorbell. Maybe somebody will show me how a vacuum works, you know, but back then, you know, what a delight to have someone to talk to for a minute.
But there was a tremendous social cost borne by any woman that had to work.
Sure. Yeah.
Right.
100%.
So trying to put that face on where it's like, I'm not doing this because I have to, I'm doing it because I love this book on child rearing. I mean, she must have been quite a salesperson.
There were, I guess it's after the war. So there are more independent women who have actually tasted,
right,
the initiative and whatever they had, employment they had during the war. And would have wanted a side gig. So she also, it was probably not uncommon. Then there was a company called Stanley Home Products that was one of these, you demonstrate the cheese grater in your house and hopefully some of your friends will buy some at a little party you throw.
Right.
Which is not a party. It's a captive audience for your sales pitch.
But Tupperware being the most famous version.
Yeah, Tupperware kind of invented that, I think. It was a struggling company that survived on the strength of one female employee saying, what if we did the sales in homes?
Are we going to save Tupperware for a separate omnibus?
I think so.
We're not going to burn it up right here, okay. Are we?
Well, forget what I just said about Tupperware. Yeah. Future, I know the Tupperware survived, and some of it probably still has enchiladas in it.
Probably some of you are living in Tupperware.
Do you think they're still finding like our old spinach lasagna in Tupperware and living off of that in the dystopian future?
I bet that some of the futurelings are sentient spinach lasagnas that sat in that kind of vacuum and
that aerobic atmosphere produced.
That's right,
complex life
produced intelligence. Yeah.
If it doesn't burp when you open it, do not eat that lasagna, especially if you are lasagna. While she was doing one of these demonstrations, she met a woman named, and I swear this is real, Ova Heath Spoonmore.
Sure.
Ova Spoonmore.
Ova Spoonmore.
Ova Spoonmore sounds patently like a fake tombstone name, like on the spine of a fake book.
Ova Spoonmore.
How to Please Your Husband by I'm a Kisser, or these fake.
Sure.
Where it's like not even a plausible first name.
Future of Breakfast Cereal by Ova Spoonmore.
Exactly. But Ova Heath Spoonmore was an actual woman whose father had been a tanner and who noticed one day.
That's what Spoonmore means.
Spoonmore?
It's
all the Spoonmores were tanners.
They were tanners.
All the way back to Jamestown. He had noticed that his hands... This mental picture is cracking me up. His hands, he still had youthful, smooth baby hands.
From using lye to tan hides?
From his tanning stuff, even though his face was was gnarled and wrinkled. So imagine this man with his weird baby hands thinking,
sure.
My God, what have I done?
It just burned the calluses off day in, day out, keeping his hands soaking in the vats.
So he and his daughter came up with skincare formulas, based on whatever his awful tanning solutions were.
Interesting.
And
have you ever been to a tannery?
I have not.
It's maybe the worst smell outside of an abattoir.
I bet it's a similar smell.
It's really a very similar smell.
They get the outside, the abattoir gets the inside, right?
But the tanners like let it sit and...
You have to, right?
Yeah, they're not turning the insides into delicious hamburger. They're like scraping the insides off the outsides. It's pretty bad. Let's not go into it.
Do you think the tanners in Full House also smelled bad? The Tanner family? Were they all tanners? Do you think John Stamos was a tanner and a rock star on that show?
This is the generation gap between you and me, because I couldn't tell you two things about Full House. I know John Stamos was the drummer of the Beach Boys.
Yes.
But other than that, I don't know anything about him, and I never saw that television show.
He's in the Kokomo video.
Did Full House have an adorable set of twin girls, yes. Little girls? Okay, so I know that. Wait, that's not Mary-Kate. And it Ashley,
is. I'm watching you discover borderline millennial culture.
Do you know that I met Mary-Kate and Ashley?
Do you know which one? They were
together.
You met them both.
I met them both in the lobby of the Chateau Marmont. And they were sitting, by this point, they were like full on like eyeshadow wearing millennial cigarette smokers. And we were all kind of sitting around in the lobby, on those big cushy sofas, just having drinks and smoking cigarettes back when you could smoke cigarettes. And just had an encounter with them. They're very nice.
Oh, that's nice. That was, yeah. I wanted that to be the takeaway.
Yeah, no, I liked them a lot.
They don't keep up with you though? They don't?
We didn't exchange numbers at the end, no.
So in 1963, Mary Kay Ash, not Mary Kate Olsen, but Mary Kay Ash, buys the tannery the lye and hog fat formula or whatever it is from the Spoonmore family. And because she thinks it's, you know, could be a beauty line.
And this was a chance encounter she had with the Spoonmores?
Yeah, I think it was one of these homewares parties, I think, you know. It was a sales thing. She was working for Stanley Home Products at the time, but she had been passed over for promotion by a less qualified man.
See.
I'm sure that kind of thing.
I wish
never
I had
happened.
The confidence of a less confident
of a mediocre Dallas white man in 1963. Actually, that is quite probably a lot of confidence.
A lot of confidence. Even a guy who didn't have confidence would have had to have been projecting confidence.
And I feel like you don't even have to say mediocre there because it's implied in white Dallas man of 1963.
Yeah.
Except for Lee Harvey Oswald.
Right, who excelled.
Of all the white Dallas men of 1963, you know who really made things happen.
You know, Lyndon Johnson was peaking right about then, but he wasn't from Dallas. He was from out in the hill country.
Yes. I was just reading this morning about how LBJ, this is
unrelated.
Unrelated.
How weird.
Speaking of yodeling.
That this show would have an unrelated digression.
We'll cut this out because people hate when we talk about anything except for Mary Kay Pink Cadillacs. Yeah,
just get straight to the story is what they want.
That he would complain about the temperature so much on Air Force One that they finally just installed a knob and said, sir, now you can control the heat. And it was
an idiot knob?
Yeah, it was attached to nothing.
like the slider that we have at the studio for the guy from the label?
That's what you tell the label guy?
Yeah.
I thought that's what you told the musicians.
Oh, I've been in that studio too. Here's your guitar. Just you turn it up when you want it louder.
So after being passed over by Stanley Home Products, boo, she goes out on her own with this...
With a new formula, something that she's not just selling, she's producing. Now.
Yes, and it's the Spoonmore hog fat, whatever it is, that keeps your hands weirdly young. And by the following year, she has kind of her first annual seminar for her little sales force of 200 people. She hangs balloons and crepe paper in a warehouse.
So this was an immediate success if she had 200 people.
I think there's a big
the first year.
As today in many places, there's a big audience of sellers, particularly women that want a flexible schedule, but they still want to do something outside the home that allows them to be there when the kids get home from school.
And they want smooth hands. Or they know people
hopefully
who do.
Their neighbors want smooth hands. We all want smooth hands.
How much does smoothness affect your decision-making viz hands?
like as far as who I trust?
Well, or your own hands.
Oh, I don't really have any kind of skin regimen.
Yeah.
Isn't that awful? At some point I should.
I feel like my hands are smooth and I wish they were rougher.
That would convey...
That I'm better at sword fighting.
You have podcaster's hands, John.
I do.
You need to.
I do.
All they've been is on the idiot slider.
My left hand has calluses on the fingertips from playing guitar.
I don't even want to... Oh, okay, guitar. Thank goodness. I was worried about that sentence for a second. So in 1964, at this first seminar, Mary Kay is running the whole operation herself. She bones the chicken. The obituary I read for her says she made the jello the jalapeno dressing and jello salad herself. And hopefully that's not one dish. Hopefully the jalapeno dressing is for the bone chicken.
Jalapeno dressing in 1960.
It's Texas.
Wow. Pretty exciting though. I guess
she's a spicy, fun lady.
If you put enough mayonnaise in it,
she's got moxie. That's what we understand. She's a peppery. She's a feisty Texas mom.
Sure, I get it now.
But I'm just hoping that there's no Oxford comma. So I don't know. I don't know if jalapeno dressing and jello salad is the side that she made, and that's not impossible. Also in 1963,
I love that in her obituary it has a line about the food that she served at her coming out party.
Well, you know how obituaries work. That is the before picture,
right?
Because that would go on. You know, by 1965, her company had, Mary Kay had $1 million in sales. And by 1992, it's on the Fortune 500. At this point, she's living in a $5 million, 30-room pink Dallas mansion. She loved pink. She was always dressed in bright bubblegum pink. You know, the mansion has 28-foot ceilings, crystal chandeliers, and specifically, it has one bathroom modeled off exactly an exact replica of one that her friend Liberace has.
She's actually friends with Liberace.
She's by this time friends with Liberace, I assume because of their shared aesthetic.
Now, this suggests so many questions. And my first question, and it's a question I have about all of the sort of successful mass marketed or buzz marketed products, which is the success tied to the quality of the product? Is her stuff, is that hand cream actually innovative and unprecedented such that the success is somehow like she invented a better mousetrap?
That's an interesting question, specifically with Mary Kay Ash, because the company was throughout her life very much a personality cult. And I think that's why it thrived. I mean, to this day, it's one of the top 10 direct sales companies in America.
Even now?
Yeah, it's top five. I think it's six today. It's you know, it's still behind who you'd expect, Amway and Avon and Herbalife, and maybe a couple other weird names that sound like failed car models that you've never heard of because you don't live in Provo, Utah. But it's still one of the best, it's still one of the biggest, most successful direct sales companies in America. And it's largely on the strength of her brand, not the smooth spoon more hands,
yeah,
but the feisty mom who tells you that I want to give a generation of women all the opportunities I didn't have. And specifically, this being Texas, mixed in with religion. She would say, you know, God does not want you slaving away 14 hours a day just to put mac and cheese on the table for your kids. He wants you to have something better. It's kind of an upwardly mobile
version
of the American prosperity gospel.
Exactly. So generally, when we talk about something on the program, through the mysteries of time travel, which we don't like to discuss directly.
We don't fully understand them ourselves.
We hear from futurelings who, I mean, anytime we mention even the smallest town in America, someone will reply within hours saying that's where they're from.
And here's some photos of the thing you just mentioned.
Yeah.
It's a problem with podcasting is that we're going to spend an hour and 10 minutes talking about a thing we have no firsthand experience with, and then we will receive a dozen letters from people with actual firsthand experience, and we will roll our eyes and hit delete.
I tried this the other day on my podcast Roadwork, where I said at the top of the episode, I don't know how many listeners I have in Istanbul, but to my Istanbul listeners, something. I don't know what I was talking about. But I got a tweet today from a guy that was like, listening to your show from my house here in Istanbul. And he was a Turkish guy. You know, he's not an expatriate. He's just some fan in Turkey. So what I would like is for, I don't want to hear from futurelings. That's not to say I don't, but I'm not asking for you to tell me that your mom uses Mary Kay products. I want to hear only from futurelings who themselves use Mary Kay products.
This is the Consumer Report side of you. You want testimonials.
I do.
You want ratings on a scale of red nipple to black half circle.
And in particular, if you sell Mary Kay products, I want you to be explicit about that. But I really want to hear people who don't sell the products, but just use the products, what you feel is the advantage of Mary Kay.
So let's assume they're just...
We'll add your comments to our addenda episode.
That's right. We want to know.
Because everyone wants to know.
In fact, send us some. We'll try them out.
Oh, there you go.
I'll put some on my hands, but not my face, and see if I turn into a creepily doll-handed Tanner.
Ken and I both have creepy doll hands already, so I don't know where we'll put them, on the soles of our feet.
But what I'm assuming is it's a company that sells perfectly serviceable cosmetics,
right?
But through the kind of the business savvy and force of personality of its founder and brand, it does very well. And the Cadillacs are a big part of that. Like, the reason why I mentioned that first annual seminar is because that has become a yearly Vegas scale extravaganza in Dallas.
Where all the sales force
comes in and gets, you know, pays big money to get an annual seminar from, you know, while she was still alive, Mary Kay herself, straight from her crystal chandeliered bathroom. I mean, that's why we can't tax the rich.
Right.
By the way.
Absolutely not.
How will they afford Liberace's chandelier in their bathroom? They won't even be able to see.
So this is like this is the first Stoll universe of like wealthy flash, like wealthy mid-century flash.
Yeah, and it's targeting people who don't have that, for whom it's very aspirational.
Right.
And this is the difficulty of the direct selling, I mean, the ethical and the professional difficulty of the direct sales sector.
Because it's kind of like the lottery, it's like a tax on the people who can least afford it.
It really is. I mean, when you look at the numbers, the industry likes to call it direct sales or affiliate marketing, because to them, what distinguishes it is that you don't have a store. You're not waiting for someone to walk in the door. Ding-a-ling-a-ling. Right. Hey, what you're actually doing is approaching friends.
There's no overhead.
Trusted people you know that you can say, hey, this is good mascara, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just that there's no, it's not just that there's low overhead. To them, the secret sauce is the trust and the relationships.
Right.
In fact, what it's often called outside the industry is multi-level marketing and other less kind things like pyramid scheme. Because what happens at Mary Kay and other direct sales companies is most of your income does not come from the mascara you sell. It's because you get a cut of what your unit sells.
Right. So you're not you're not just trying to sell it. You're trying to sell the idea of it to
if you get somebody else to pay the $100 to get the Mary Kay starter kit, then you get 4% of whatever they sell. And if your unit becomes bigger, you get 9% and even 13% of what they sell.
Now, how many people do you think lucked out and recruited like one of the great salespeople of all time? And then they didn't have to do anything. They had somebody down the pyramid from them that was really hustling.
I mean, there's a reason why it's called a pyramid. The group at the bottom is so much bigger. Like of the millions and millions, $100 million or whatever that Mary Kay, I don't have a number, but you know, of the hundreds of millions of dollars that Mary Kay brags that it grosses every year, it's really concentrated in a small group of people. And that's true of the multi-level marketing industry as a whole. You know, depending on I think Mary Kay says its average salesperson sells makes $1,057 a year.
Hmm.
And their annual turnover is somewhere between 68 and 85%.
Of salespeople.
Yeah. So most people do not stick it out. You need to, it's a pyramid scheme. You need to constantly be finding new marks.
So if they earn $1,000, how much did they have to buy in order to, I mean, how much money did it end up costing them?
Well, see, okay, that's another tricky thing. Multi-level marketing is legal in the United States as a result of a 1979 FTC decision, In re Amway.
Oh, In re Amway.
In which the government actually considered, should companies be allowed
to run this thing? eBay.
I mean, Amway is such a bad name that it recently, not recently, but 10 years or so ago, 15 years ago, it briefly changed its name to Quickstar in hope that that would fool people into being able to tell their friends. Because the number one thing you hear...
That happened to Est, too.
What is Est called now?
Est is called...
It's also called Quickstar.
The System or something. It changed its name.
Weirdly, Est is called Amway, which was super ill-advised.
Weirdly, Quickstar now is my internet service provider.
Quickstar does sound exactly like a cable company. I think that's what they wanted. And the idea was, because when you tell your friends, hey, you know, I've got this cool new thing to tell you about, a generation knew that the number one thing you ask is this Amway?
Right.
And watch the person's kind of pupils go sideways. Because it's the worst to be friends with someone who
is an Amway salesperson.
It's so
because even that became a punchline in stand-up comedy, right? Like Amway salesman was a...
It's not what you do if you can do anything else.
Right.
Let's put it that way. The last person I knew who was trying to tell me all about his amazing Quickstar opportunity was a guy who drove a school bus 3 hours a day, but could not make ends meet on it and did not know what to do with the rest of his day, which is sad. When you look at the studies on multi-level marketing, the Amway numbers are not unusual. At least half of the people drop out after the first year and only 10% make it past 5 years. It's a career for a tiny number of people. In the best case studies, you're going to average about $2,500 annual income, and that might sound good until you realize the time commitment of constantly annoying your friends. It works out to about $1.50 an hour. It's not minimum wage.
And
according to the worst case studies, actually 99% of people that try an MLM lose money.
Right. But the people that are succeeding, is it because they are selling?
No.
Or it's because they've sold?
They are never selling.
I see.
They are building up what you call a downline. All the emphasis in the materials is about how the real money is in building up your downline. And I can speak pretty authoritatively on this because I used to live in Utah,
right,
which is ground zero for all of America's biggest multi-level marketing companies.
And why is that? Is Deseret Industries involved somehow?
Deseret Industries is just Mormon Goodwill. It's a thrift shop and it gives job experience. Okay. Yeah, it's exactly Goodwill. But this is all unaffiliated with the Mormon Church, but it is not unaffiliated with Mormon culture.
Uh-huh.
I guess I should say that more correctly. It is unaffiliated with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Right.
But it is very bound up in Mormon culture.
It's, in Jell-O salad and pink Cadillacs.
The companies themselves, like to all these Utah-based companies, New Skin and whatever.
Whoa.
So forth.
Is that some kind of like, is that some sort of like robot slave company?
New Skin sounds definitely like a Soylent type product from a dystopian future Blade Runner movie, right?
Yeah, it does.
The new models come with, and it's spelled NU, so it looks even more like a Blade Runner thing. they will tell you it's really because Mormon missionary culture means that we've got a built-in skilled sales force here.
Oh, of course, and you're used to having people ring the doorbell.
In fact, I think that it could not be less relevant. there's no guarantee that serving a 2-year mission actually makes somebody a good salesman for a tricky product, and it certainly may not apply to Tahitian berry shampoo.
This is a question that's never occurred to me, but if you live in Utah, do Mormon missionaries come to the door and ring the doorbell? Or is it the one state in the nation one place in the world where you're safe from?
It's like, can you tickle yourself? No, in fact, Utahns are not safe.
Have you heard the good news?
Yes. Yeah, I've heard. There's one brick building on that block with a basketball court, and one on the next block, and two on the next block. There are plenty of Latter-day Saint missionaries in Utah, and it's because success in that field, it's affiliate marketing, basically. Uh-huh. Success does not come from cold calling on a doorbell and being like, hey, would you like to change religions? Actually, yes, come in.
Right.
It's all going to be people who have a friend who their kids attend church together. You know, we were talking about that at the sleepover. We went on the scout camp trip, you know. It's going to be people whose friends are, have already been warmed up a bit. So, yes, there is a booming missionary industry in Utah and a growing immigrant Latino population that might be interested in assimilating to the friendly local community religion.
It's not just kids that couldn't get visas.
I wonder if there's any of that.
You've got to go on a mission, but you can't leave the United States, so.
Well, there's definitely some of that. Now the church needs to know, in the Trump era, the church needs to know people's immigration status.
Oh,
because, yeah. They'd love to send this this bright Latino kid to preach the good word in El Salvador, but what if ICE doesn't let him back in, So the real reasons, I think, have more to do with partly the prosperity gospel thing you mentioned, kind of a self-conception that I'm a good person, I'm doing everything right. Clearly God will give me an income stream.
Absolutely. Well, and what does God love more than private property? And how does he show his love other than rewarding you with private property?
What does God love more than showing Cutco knives to the ladies from church? And I think really the foundational reason is just demographic. 46% of women in their 30s and 40s in Utah County, Utah, do not work outside the home.
I see.
Which is not true of many other parts of the East States. Yeah, that's crazy. Like only in Utah County, 6 to 8% of men that age don't currently have a day job. So you have all these moms who are going bananas at home. All the soaps have been canceled.
Right.
All the good game shows are gone except for Price is Right.
They're putting all those bananas into Jell-O salads.
there's Jell-O to set, but then there's hours free. the American post-war efficiency boom meant that you no longer need somebody 8 hours a day to do the chores.
You can only clean your house so much.
But there's a lot of barriers to entry to full-time work. There's certainly social barriers. There might still be, Barbara's kids are still at home, and yet she's working at a real estate agent's office.
Well, somewhere along the line, and it must have been Mary Kay, somewhere along the line in the United States, this kind of multi-level marketing became an acceptable form of work for a housewife when it started was considered very déclassé or very scandalous that a woman would be going door to door. But then it became a kind of social.
I assume it's like a virus.
Event.
I assume it's like a virus in that it becomes endemic.
Right.
And you're right. Like putting a social face on it is clever.
Having your friends over
for a pampered chef party and showing them how good the garlic press is.
Right.
I think the branding, putting the pink Cadillac face on it was very smart. I think Mary Kay was instrumental in that. In Utah, there's no I mean, there is everyone knows it's an annoyance.
Yeah.
But the basis for the stigma is not, well, she should be a better mom. It's more like she should leave me alone, or more like she keeps bugging me about her essential oils.
I wonder how many people, in places where multi-level marketing is common, how many people are known in the community as someone who will come to your Tupperware party, eat, and leave. They're never going to buy, but they take advantage of the opportunity, the free sample.
I'll tell you what, you know who the salespeople are, because they will work their church community as if it were a client list.
Right.
And nobody really likes that. Like we moved into a new neighborhood in Utah. The first house we owned, bought a little starter home in Utah in, I guess, 2002. And we went to church one Sunday, and then a woman called up my wife the next week, you know, super bubbly and chatty, just wanted to welcome you to the neighborhood, blah, blah, blah. You see where this is going.
Yeah, of course.
You know, 15 minutes of chit chat later. Hey, this might seem like an odd question, but what do you do with your photos? Mindy was like, my photos? Yeah. What do you do with all your photos? Oh, I think I just keep them in a box under my bed.
Oh.
And she was like, and she was just,
you could hear the hooks, her reel just spinning.
Her spiel was, either shock or feigned shock. You do what?
Right.
Like, how could someone do something so awful with their photos as keep them in a box under your bed? So you don't scrapbook?
Oh, dear.
Oh, no, I really don't. You know, and so this woman turned on her scrapbooking pitch, and Mindy was like, well, you know, as I said, I don't really scrapbook. I just have a box of photos that I need to sort at some point.
When I hear someone say they don't scrapbook, I know it's just someone who's never scrapbooked.
When I hear someone say, I don't scrapbook, I get out my Browning.
Mm.
Like that's it's a sign of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a whole industry.
Have you been to one of these parties? Have you ever been like actually like sat on the couch in a full living room?
I have not. I was invited to a Pampered Chef party in college. There were college kids trying to make an extra buck doing this. Oh, you know, my sister briefly did Cutco knives, and she came over to our house and showed us how well they sharpen or how sharp they slice or whatever it is they do.
How slice they sharp.
Something. Do you have firsthand MLM experience?
I went to it wasn't Tupperware. I went to a party in 1977. My best friend's mom went through a phase where she was going to, and she worked full time, but she was going to supplement her income by having these parties.
Weren't you like a nine-year-old boy?
I was a nine-year-old, and I went to the party because my friend invited me. I guess he said, you know, my mom is having a party.
He's part of the problem.
Can I bring a friend?
What they'll do is they'll say, oh, you know, I just need to practice. I just started selling this, and I just need a group to practice on. And of course, they're going to hit you up.
Yeah. And she was selling candles or something, some sort of candles or candle holders, and I ended up buying one. like I broke my piggy bank. I was all excited about it.
MLMs of the future, please note, John Roderick will buy your scrapbooking stuff.
9-year-old boys.
That's your new market.
Buy your candles.
It's true that 9-year-old boys are terrible. I was a very tight-fisted 9-year-old.
I was too.
I knew what I was saving up for, but you apparently had been wowed by the candle.
I was very tight-fisted, but I think the pitch was that this would be a good gift for my mom.
I'm sure that's what she said. That's what the book told her to say.
Yeah, and so I was excited because it was the one thing I would break my piggy bank to do was to buy a gift for my mom, and I did give it to her, the candle holder, and we still have it.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. It's in a box of Christmas things.
Do you think it's possible that you were hypnotized with the candle?
Hypnotized.
Do you think she used the candle on you?
Oh.
To get you interested in candle culture?
You know, I felt like this party was very exciting.
grown up, right?
There were all these women that that were from around the neighborhood. They'd all kind of dressed up for it. You know, it was like they came. It was a night out.
It was a time you knew your neighbors,
yeah.
Which is, you know, probably a barrier to entry in many places today.
They were drinking wine. They were laughing. Aaron's mom gave a presentation about these, and I got swept up in it.
In the end of Mindy's story, of course, is the once she told this woman she didn't scrapbook, this woman never talked to her again.
Oh.
At church or elsewhere.
Well, sure.
Because
either you scrapbook or you don't.
She's not interested in, I mean, I don't even think that was the barrier. It was like, you know, if you're not in my downline, I don't have time for you. You're not helping my bottom line. The FCC keeps a, the FTC keeps a pretty close eye on, multi-level marketing. I don't, what do you say? That's not a scheme. Multi-level marketing outfits.
Yeah. Outfits.
Because some of them are literal pyramid schemes. The internal test the FTC uses is often internal consumption. How many people are, high on their own supply, basically. Like, if are you buying stuff on, are you buying product just to get up to the sales tier where you can claim a commission, and then putting a bunch of hand cream on a credit card? Because that's what's very common here. People will not do as well as they thought. They will buy their own stuff and stockpile it and accumulate credit card debt in order to make these commission tiers.
I see.
And often they victimize, I think Herbalife in particular has been criticized for victimizing vulnerable populations. Latinos, for example, they, you know, they'll go to developing world cities and sell this as a way, you know, a way to pull yourself up by your bootstraps and, you know, bring people into further financial ruin, I think, in a lot of cases. To the degree that China has now banned, or China for a while banned any Western multi-level marketing scheme.
Huh.
Obviously, a place with a new middle class is perfect for that. And in the Muslim world in particular, it is often explicitly haram.
It sounds haram.
It's not. I mean, it should be haram.
It's haram to me.
It's not Quranic in that, you know, you are giving exchange without credit and credit without exchange or whatever. You know, it violates
sure.
the Quranic principles of sound business sense. So there's places you literally can't do it. But a big part of putting a in Utah, it's so huge that, you know, everybody on your block, you know, half the people, half the women on your block have or are selling something. And a bunch of them, you know, you're going to know 10 people who work for one of the big companies. My brother was the in-house counsel at one of these places, and he just hated it because, you know, thanks to Orrin Hatch, it's now legal to make vague good health claims about this stuff without actually doing any FDA approval processes.
Right. It's like, just vitamin C and ground up horse hooves.
So he would spend his whole time keeping the sales staff from making specific prosecutable claims. That seems
like such a fun job.
The sales staff hated him. You know, the higher ups hated him because he's the guy who always says no.
Right.
And he was afraid he was going to just be practicing MLM law for life. And he jumped when he saw a tech company, and he's much happier doing, you know, IP law and tech stuff.
Oh yeah. He keeps his hands clean with IP law.
Right, but not unwrinkled, you know. If he had stayed with Tahitian Noni, he would have the power of Noni Berry, keeping his skin smooth and unlined. But one of the things that really made this kind of scammy business model an acceptable part of American public life was the genius move by Mary Kay Ash to introduce pink Cadillacs. The Mary Kay organization has a bunch of, you know, giving these tiers is very smart because it makes people really kill themselves to get to the next tier.
Right.
You know, it's the same reason you give a Boy Scout a merit badge. You know, the salespeople will wear little gold jewel brooches called the Ladder of Success, where you get a new little jeweled pin on each rung of the ladder.
Oh, wow. So you can look right at someone's lapel and know where they are. And
tell how good they are at selling, eye shade. But the real stroke of genius was, of course, the cars. In 1968, she went to a Lincoln lot and said she wanted a custom pink Cadillac to help.
You can't get a Cadillac at a Lincoln lot.
Sorry, she went to a Lincoln lot and asked for a custom Lincoln to publicize her booming new business. And they gave her kind of a Texas, well, little lady, when your husband agrees to.
Yeah, right.
By the way, in the meantime, she and her husband had planned this this hand cream business based on the Tanner recipes, only to have him die of a heart attack. Right before...
This is her second husband.
Right. Her second husband died of a heart attack immediately before they were going to launch this. And she ended up kind of having to do it without her beloved George.
Wow.
Who died when they were on the brink of this. And she made a go of it by herself. So she was in no mood to have some Lincoln salesman...
Call her a little lady.
Give her the runaround and say, you come in with your husband and we'll put you in a Lincoln. So she goes to a Cadillac dealership where they are only too happy to sell her.
Sure. There you go. General Motors comes to the rescue.
And, but her... What she wants is one that matches a very specific shade of Mary Kay blush. She shows them Mountain Laurel and says, can you do this? And they say, well, we've never done that before, but okay, we'll do a custom paint job. And so Cadillac dealership began painting Cadillacs Mountain Laurel for her.
Let me just say that the 1968 Cadillac front end is, I think, one of the most beautiful American cars.
It was a Coupe de Ville. Is that what you're picturing?
Their largest
sedan.
And I think that they are, especially the convertible, the 1968 convertible Coupe de Ville I guess it would be the DeVille, the convertible DeVille, such an icon. I've always coveted one.
I want to look at one right now. And futurelings, I encourage you, if there's a wrecked Coupe de Ville.
Yeah. If there are any futurelings out there who have a 1965 through 68 Cadillac Coupe de Ville convertible that want to sell it to me, I'll buy it.
No picture, no internet photo can contain this car.
No.
It's spilling off the front and the back of every picture I look at.
It's as big as a house. It really is.
That is fantastic. Look at that. And you can imagine the effect one of these would have in bright Mary Kay pink.
Well, it would enter your field of vision and be there for like 3 minutes before it exited the other side.
What was that pink rectangle? And in 1969, she decided her top five sellers should have one as well. And that began the tradition of
thus begat
a fleet of pink Cadillacs. And as you mentioned, the American South, this was not new. Elvis famously had a showy pink Cadillac that he toured in. And I think that's what gives us the Bruce Springsteen B-side.
Pink Cadillac.
If you've listened to the lyrics, it's clear that a pink Cadillac is not a car. He loves the...
Is it a dildo?
Yes. Bruce Springsteen is singing about using his favorite pink Cadillac, which he gets from under the mattress. No. The boss is saying that he loves a woman mostly because he just loves driving her pink Cadillac. So it's
oh dear.
He's singing about her euphemism.
Oh my goodness.
Are you going to go burn all your Springsteen records?
Well, no, I didn't have any Springsteen records, but you know, I'm not sure whether I like him more or less, maybe more.
So that, you know, that post dates the Mary Kay thing and makes kind of the saucy joke of a woman driving a pink Cadillac a little funnier. But there was some, because of Elvis, there was prior art for a pink Cadillac signifying showy prosperity in the American South. Today, if you reach the sales director level of Mary Kay success, that would be selling $100,000 a year, you and your unit.
Oh boy.
You get what they call, you get to join the, it is a big unit. They don't make the DeVille anymore. Of course, when the DeVille was succeeded by the DTS, Mary Kay began to use the DTS, and today it's the XT5, the crossover I saw at Glacier, now in this new pearly pink cover. But you join the career car program, and you can choose to get a monthly stipend, or you can choose to drive the car. And there's different levels.
Like, so you don't own the car.
That's the thing. A lot of people don't know this. It's a 2-year lease.
Whoa!
And at the end of the lease, you can either buy the car or you can sell it. And if you sell it back to the dealership, they will just repaint it because you're not allowed to. Like, they have Mary Kay has a specific agreement with Cadillac that you can't drive a car that color. They won't sell a car that color to anyone but a certified Mary Kay 100K a year sales
director. Oh, so that's why you never see them on the used market? I would think that, like, Bring a Trailer would be full of pink
Right, Mary in Kay the same Cadillacs. Way that you see old cop cars or hearses or whatever.
Or Wienermobiles.
I don't want to know how they repaint that. In the case of these, the dealership is obligated to repaint them and resell them as a normal color Cadillac. There are different tiers, by the way. Like at the lowest, I don't know what these are called, but you start out by getting a silver Malibu, then you can work your way up to or like a black Chevy Cruze, I think. You can work your way up to a black Mustang. That's kind of the newest edition. And at the top level, I think it's the pink Cadillac. And maybe a lot of people go for the black Mustang or whatever, just because they don't want to be associated with, 100% associated with driving that.
In the 80s, I remember showing, there was the woman that had the pink Cadillac, but then there was a woman showed up driving a pink K car. And it was, and it said Mary Kay on it, and it was obviously like,
that must have been one of the lower tiers
at
the time,
yeah.
Instead of the Chevy Cruze.
But it was still pink, it was that bright pink. It was just like not yet a Cadillac level.
The impression I get today is you only get pink at the highest level. Like that's membership hath its privileges, and it's more about the color. I mean, also the Cadillac XT5 is a much nicer car than the Chevy Cruze. But really what certifies you is the color. In 1993, Mary Kay made headlines for breaking down one of America's last and most important gender barriers.
What, she was elected president of the United States?
Do you not remember that brief period?
Wow.
A lot of people don't know this, but between George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton, the presidential line of succession is such that Mary Kay Ash was briefly, the first male Mary Kay consultant earned a pink Cadillac.
Oh, wow.
Craig Hogan and his 60-woman downline of Houston,
Craig
Texas.
Hogan and his 60-woman downline won the Tony Award
what
that year.
What a name for a band. he loved the men's line of Mary Kay. There's a men's line of Mary Kay product. Mm-hmm. Just something for our listeners to keep in mind if you want to send us a gift.
Keep your fingers soft like a child's bottom.
It's, but only to this day, only 2% of their sales force is male. But Craig Hogan, kind of a blonde, toothy, Texan man. I don't want to speculate. He now does luxury realty for Coldwell Banker, but he was recently interviewed by a podcast for America's largest LGBT, realtor, professional group,
right?
Whatever you call it. So I assume that Craig Hogan was the, the flamboyant pal of all the wealthy Texas women.
Mm-hmm.
And he went all on all the morning shows because he became the first male pink Cadillac driver. And in fact,
I'm sure that made him a lot of money.
His Texas vanity plate said first man.
Oh yeah. But his wife wasn't the governor. He was the first.
Yeah. The first
Mary Kay,
the first man of Texas was not Ann Richards' husband. It was, this guy who's could use his sassy catty gossip to get all the women to buy Mary Kay. So that's an important glass ceiling broken. Thank you, Craig.
Well, so is Mary Kay still with us?
Mary Kay Ash passed away after a long illness in 2001. She had a stroke in 1996 and was never in good health for the last 5 years of her life.
That's too bad.
But it's still a family company. I think they went public and then re-went private at some point in the 90s. And you know what? She actually left her big Liberace mansion at some point and moved into a much smaller house. And so she became one of these, I guess it's at a higher level of wealth, you become the person, the guy driving a Volvo level,
Yeah, that's right.
Where it's less showy, so she would still be seen around Texas, just pushing her own shopping cart in the supermarket. She'd have a security guy behind her, but she was now at the post Liberace level of wealth. And she was a beloved fixture of Dallas, Texas.
Yeah. That's where do you find that balance between like being achieving all your wealth dreams, but then also like being a Jell-O salad person? You came from Jell-O salad and you returned to Jell-O salad.
You must have to go through the fire. You must have to have your rumspringa of buying a stupid Lamborghini
right
before you graduate into Volvo dad mode.
You come back around and you're like, I loved when my avocado stove matched my avocado refrigerator. How do I get back to that? And that concludes Mary Kay Pink Cadillacs, entry 762.2K0930, certificate number 29266 in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that social media still exists in your era, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram are archived at Omnibus Project. Our handles were at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick. I'm also on Instagram under my same name. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. We encourage you to seek out one of our fan groups, like, for instance, The Futurelings on Facebook.
Try to sell them Cutco knives and Pampered Chef pizza cutters.
They're going to try to sell you on mail trucks and Quonset huts.
You try to sell them scrapbooking stuff.
See who wins.
Whatever you do, don't keep your photos in a box under the bed. You'll have no friends immediately.
There are Reddit. There's a Reddit fan group that we're on TikTok. We're archived at the Library of Congress.
Check out our SoundCloud.
You can mail us things, including a 1965 to 1968 Cadillac DeVille convertible at P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington 98155. And in our own odd multi-level marketing,
It's scheme. Not really multi-level because
I'm about to make it multi-level.
You're going to see if the Patreon donors can recruit.
I would like you to go out and get five friends to donate to our patreon.com/omnibusproject Patreon account. And it's not donate really, it's support. And for every 10 people, 10 of your friends that you get to support the Omnibus Project at patreon.com/omnibusproject, we will up your futureling level.
Up the ladder of success
We're going to bump you up one level from your own level of donation to the next highest level of privilege and access.
Wait, are we really going to do that?
Yes. So if you get 10, if you can document that you got 10 people to donate to the show, we're going to give you a free upgrade.
Well, you know what? People write us apologetically saying, you know, these are really tough times. Yeah. I can't really donate every month to a podcast. And, you know, I feel bad that they feel bad.
Yeah.
This is a free podcast.
I don't feel bad.
You should donate because you enjoy supporting the community and you're getting something out of it.
That's true.
But people sometimes ask, how can I support the show? Are there other ways to support the show beyond becoming a Patreon supporter? And absolutely. I mean,
get your rich friends to support the show.
That's 100% true. It is a multi-level marketing answer.
Go to your church, or when new people come to your church, call them up, welcome them to town,
and ask them which podcast they like. Uh-huh. And if they only listen to podcasts under their bed, you slam the phone down. That's right. No, but quite seriously, like writing a review for a podcast you enjoy, telling friends about a podcast you enjoy, that's priceless.
Yeah, go on iTunes and give us a good review. That would be a wonderful thing for someone to do.
Build up a downline of omnibus listeners.
Convert your friends.
If nothing else, they will applaud your wonderful taste in recordings.
Walk around your neighborhood with a giant boombox listening to Omnibus, and when people ask you what you're listening to, even if they seem kind of annoyed at first, I'm sure you can convince them.
As they cock their guns. Re-elect Mayor Goldie Wilson. Ba, 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 ba. Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We have no idea if Mayor Goldie Wilson's going to be elected or not. I hope he does. He'll sure clean up this town.
He will.
We hope and pray that...
I like the sound of this.
We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, then Mary Kay Cosmetics is our last show. And what a fitting tombstone for
good,
the Omnibus.
Good note to go out on.
Like all our recordings, this could be our final word. We have no idea. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.